Recording. Okay, over to you, Francis.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the 67th webinar on the Secret Teachings of All Ages by Manly P. Hall. This webinar series, where am I at here? Let me get back to where I'm supposed to be. I thought we were there. Okay. This webinar series is available on makara.us under the subheadings Mori Federation Webinars. And then webinar series in progress, these two boxes. Previous episodes of this, the Secret Doctrine, and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar you wish to view. Even if you don't miss a session, I should say, but you would like to go back and go over some of the material to study it more closely. You know, the pause button, which you can't use in a live webinar, can be invaluable for gaining a better understanding of the material. So even if you show up every time, that's it can be useful for that in that way. Yeah, you can also join any of these webinar series, including Dwayne's series, Awakening the Higher Mind, right up here in the upper left-hand corner of the Mori Federation webpage. Okay.
Now, if you actually go to the web page, you'll see the updated dates. That was a screenshot in apparently December, but we do keep that posted on the Moira Federation website.
But it is still the same. Oh yeah, it says December here, but it's the same four though, right?
Right, exactly. The same four, the same place with the current dates.
Right. Yeah, okay. Okay, so we are currently in what I think is a really fascinating chapter, which is interesting because I almost skipped it. The first time I even thought about skipping a chapter because this what's called the Bimbine Table of Isis, also known as the Mensa Issiaca, was actually it's not an Egyptian artifact. It was made in the first century after Christ. But what I discovered when I kept reading the chapter is that it's its own world. It has deep significance within its interrelated within the figures of the Mensa Issiaca. So then I kind of re-engaged with new interest and was glad I did. So we began our last session by finishing our study of the long quote from Athanasius Kircher's Oedipus Aegyptiacus, which accompanies the illustration of the table, where we learned about the four main Egyptian hierarchies, including the symbols that the gods of these hierarchies have in common, such as the ankh, scepter, and was stick. You'll find these in all the Egyptian hierarchies, as well as features that were unique to each of the four groups, such as in the Ogdoad of Hermopolis, where Nonet was often depicted with a serpent's head and Nun with a frog's head, which are unique to this one Egyptian hierarchy. We then took a look at Egyptian temples, which were unparalleled in size and in the scope of their influence in the ancient world. Next, we learned about the Egyptian priests who strove through a strict adherence to ritual, as well as the use of symbols and costumery to identify with the gods they were invoking. This is not at all like The traditional, you know, for instance, Christian method where you pray to a God that is outside of you, above you, beyond you. The idea with the Egyptians was to bring the presence of this God into the temple by means of this process of identification. And the identification was brought about through very specific ritual, through symbols and the costumery, right? A fundamental different approach. Athanasius Kircher says, thus arrayed, they regarded themselves to be transformed into that intelligence with which they constantly desired to be identified. Unquote. Their mindset wasn't one of worshiping a separate and distant God, but of invoking that God so that it might manifest through them. Identification with deity allowed the priest to access higher planes, where the realm of ideas could inform their lives and thus help them to better serve. We then took a look at ancient Egyptian amulets, which afforded spiritual protection, cured illnesses, and had specific magical properties to ensure safe passage for the deceased. Next, we learned that according to Thomas Taylor, Plato was initiated into the greater mysteries in Egypt at the age of 49. There's no empirical evidence to support this, but DK, as well as many other esotericists, recognize Plato as one is a master of wisdom and an avatar for Greece when he presented there. He was actually an avatar of the quality of synthesis in the same way that Christ was an avatar for that quality called love. MPH says, after a further 3 months sojourn in the halls of the pyramids, the initiate Plato was sent out into the world to do the work of the great order as Pythagoras and Orpheus had been before him. The specifics may not be true, but certainly he was the one who followed in the footsteps. So you have first Zoroaster, the chief of the Magi, and then Hermes Trismegistus, the great avatar of Egypt. He was a third aspect, intelligent activity avatar. And then Orpheus came in the Greek world, and then Aglaophamus, who's the only one I don't know much about, was initiated in the sacred mysteries of Orpheus. Finally, Pythagoras was initiated into theology by Aglaophamus. I gotta get this right. Aglaophamus. And finally, Plato by Pythagoras. Then after a long description of how the Mensa Isiaca was discovered, this great singular tablet, where it traveled over the centuries, its proportions and metallurgical composition, finally MPH gives us a paragraph on Kircher's analysis of the content of the Mensa Isiaca. He was convinced that the tablet contained encoded knowledge that could reveal deeper spiritual truths about the Egyptian mysteries. For example, he believed that the arrangement of figures and symbols on the Mensa Isiaca depicted the cosmic order and the hierarchy of divine beings. In fact, he saw the table as a map of the universe, illustrating the relationships between different cosmic principles and their roles in the creation and maintenance of the cosmos. Kircher also interpreted some of the symbols on the tablet as alchemical in nature, representing the process of spiritual purification symbolized by the transformation of matter. Unfortunately, he never came up with a synthetic whole system where he could interrelate every aspect to every other aspect. He had many ideas about what might be going on, but he was never able to completely synthesize his understanding. Later, a guy named Westcott took what Kircher had started back in the 17th century and took it much further, and we'll be looking at quotes from Westcott's analysis. Finally, MPH, by way of Levi and Kircher, begins his description of the Mensa Ischiaca itself, quote, "It is divided into three equal compartments. Above are the 12 houses of heaven, and below are the corresponding distributions of work periods throughout the year. While in the middle place are 21 sacred signs answering to the letters of the alphabet." So here are the 12 figures in the upper register, which according to Kircher represent the 12 houses of heaven. There are also 12 figures in the lower third of the tablet, which according to Levi represent the, quote, "corresponding distributions of labor throughout the year," meaning the nature of human labor associated with each zodiacal house. Here are the upper and lower registers in proximity and how they relate to each other.
Francis?
Yeah.
Anne Veronica, thank you, Anne Veronica, says, well, I'm sorry, I'm going to murder this.
Aglaophemos
means having bright fame or splendid fame.
Thank you, Anne Veronica. That's great. So this is a Greek word, meaning having bright fame, splendid fame. That's terrific. Great. Yeah. He's certainly the least known about in terms of the world. Anne Veronica, have you ever run across his name in your studies? Is he more known to?
No, I haven't heard of him actually. Yes. I just looked him up. That Aglaophemos, Phemos means Phemi is fame.
Yeah. Okay. I
so,
see.
And the other part of the word means light and bright, bright fame. It has a meaning of light in it.
Yeah, it's like our famous, Phemos. It's like our word famous, fame, right? So both have a similar root. Oh, that's really interesting. And you finally gave me the right pronunciation, which is Aglaophemos. Not Aglaophemos, but Aglaophemos is like, yeah, it moves more like that. And I see Ben says, any significance of archways only for Ta, his consort Sekhmet, and Isis, as we discussed archways recently. Archways, I can just tell you generally, I can't give you specific details about the nature of, here, let me go back though to that page on the Egyptian, that was way back. Oh, wow, okay. Where it describes, he was one of the triad of Memphis. And he was a potter. It was of the four groups, he was the closest to being a creator god. Therefore, I would put him in the position of Kokhma, the second of the Sephiroth, in that he was directly involved. He wasn't a remote, pure spiritual orientation, but was in fact was an actual creator god along the line of Zeus or Brahma would be the Indian version of this compared to Vishnu, who is a higher sustainer god, but this is so Ta would be like Brahma, or even Jehovah, though I think Jehovah is a lower level god than Ta was. Sekhmet, Sekhmet was a very first-rate goddess. She brought the will aspect in. I don't know too much about Nefertum. Interesting, Nefertiti probably named herself after this god. But back to your question about the archways. Archways always suggest the entrance between planes, right? The portals between one plane and the next. So the archway for Ta would be the etheric realms, and the archway would exist between the etheric, where such a being as Ta would initiate his creative process, and the lower quaternary, where that process would actually take form. Right, so he's creating the archetype, which is, also represented by Uranus, those higher archetypes that we aspire to conform to or to regain. And that's about all I can do with that. Sorry, because I'm not an Egyptologist, but good question. All right, let's get back here. I'm going to go out and then come back in. Let's see. Yeah, we're looking at that. Okay. So finally, and I encourage you to keep asking questions and making comments about any of this material. It's always more interesting to have a dialogue, than a monologue. Okay, so finally, Levi tells us that the middle register, shown here, contains 21 sacred signs answering to the letters of a mystical alphabet. And that, well, he may have been referring to a higher form of alphabet, but the 21-lettered alphabet that we know of is the Hebrew alphabet, which is definitely directly related to the numbers 21 and 22. I say that because zero is associated with Aleph, the first, meaning that it's numbered up to 21, but starting with zero. When we then learned about the seated figure in the middle of the central section called the pantomorphic INX, emblem of universal being and corresponding to the Hebrew Yod, the unique letter from which, according to MPH, and probably Kircher, all other letters were formed. The INX, we're then told, is, quote, encircled by the Ophite triad answering to the three mother letters of the Egyptian and Hebrew alphabets. Ophite refers to serpents, which we see on either side of the enclosure. Third serpent is more symbolic, and it's described as being in the chamber beneath Isis. And this pretty much takes us up to where we left off last time. We'll start this session by backtracking just a little bit for context. So on the left are the Ibimorphic and Serapion triads. On the right are those of Nephthys and Hecate, representing active and passive, fixed and volatile, fructifying fire and generating water. So the term Ibimorphic refers to forms relating to Ibis, right? To the Ibis, which is a sacred Egyptian bird and was sacred to the Egyptian god Thoth, right? You'll see the ibis-headed Thoth here. God of wisdom, knowledge, and learning. The two gods most associated with Thoth in actual Egyptian theogony, as opposed to what we find within the Mensa Isiaka, they're really two whole separate cosmic orders, right? But in the actual theogony, the two gods most associated with Thoth are Maat, goddess of truth, justice, and cosmic order, and Seshat, Thoth's female counterpart, as goddess of writing, knowledge, and wisdom. However, these three are not a traditional trinity. You don't see them depicted in the same place and referred to ever in Egyptian writings as a trinity. In fact, there is no recognized quote-unquote Ibimorphic triad in Egyptian iconography. It's a concept related specifically to the Mensa Isiaka. Nor is there a traditional Serapion triad, though in contexts having to do, this is Serapis, having to do with resurrection and the afterlife, Serapis is often found in the company of Isis and Harpocrates. But that's sort of beside the point. That is to say, this has to do with Greek and Egyptian iconography, right? Not with this system that was developed within the Mensa Isiaka, which we'll be exploring in a little bit. Nephthys, also mentioned, formed two triads, depending on context. What I'm doing is exploring the gods that appear and are recognized as being within the Mensa Isiaka, and we're first looking at those in their traditional Egyptian role. And so in that role, Nephthys, sister of Isis, formed two triads, depending on the context. As part of the great Aeneid of Heliopolis, Aeneid meaning nine, she is often associated with her sister Isis, together praising her brother Osiris. So you see them here. Here's Isis in the foreground and Nephthys in the background. Very interesting goddess. I actually did a presentation on her once at the conference. She had a Christ-like role in that she would cast out her net. She's also associated with Neith, N-E-I-T-H, and literally save mankind from the waters of matter, right? So there's a this idea of casting the net didn't start with Christianity. The other triad that you see her in is with Set, her consort, and Anubis, her son, in some myths. So here she is with Set In Greek mythology, Hecate, see what we're doing is exploring the triads that MPH just mentioned as being part of that central panel of the Mensa Isiaca. So Hecate in Greek mythology is a goddess of magic, witchcraft, and crossroads. She's often associated with the triad of goddesses known as the triple goddess, depicted here. The triad represented the three phases of the moon and the stages of a woman's life, maiden, mother, and crone. But this is important. These represent traditional Greco-Egyptian relationships, which are not depicted in the Mensa Isiaca. I mean, you have to carry forward some of this meaning in your understanding. So from the perspective of the Mensa Isiaca, let's look at the statement again. On the left are the Ibimorphic and Serapian triad. So here's the Ibimorphic, and here's the supposedly are the Serapian triads, but it's not. This we'll get to that. This is the actual Serapian triads. Okay, but I'm getting ahead of myself. On the left are the Ibimorphic and Serapian triads. On the right are those of Nephthys and Hecate, representing active and passive, fixed and volatile, fructifying fire and generating water. So each pair of triads represents energetic opposites, with Thoth and the solar Serapis representing the active, fiery, volatile aspect, and Nephthys and Hecate representing the quote, that would be this triad, Nephthys and Hecate, representing the quote-unquote passive fixed water generating aspect. These are the positive and negative poles that are equilibrated by the central figure. However, MPH, and this took me forever to figure out, but I finally got it. MPH got the locations on the chart of these triads wrong. In fact, the Ibimorphic triad, this is the active fiery principle, is on the left, and the Serapia triad on the right. And the reverse is true for the Nephthys and Hecate, the feminine watery triad. So it's peculiar that he missed that, but he did. Here's what W. Wynne Westcott, who's going to be our authority during our interpretation of this Mensa Isiaca, says about this ibis-headed figure. Quote, actually, let's let somebody else read this. I'm already feeling like I'm talking too much. Could we get a reader, please?
Sure, I'll start. Q is Ibimorphus, a male divinity with the head of the bird ibis. This is Hermanubis, the Mercury of the Romans, Hermes of the Greek. Ibis head denotes deity of moisture. The tessellated chair points out the ever-changing states of nature, day and night, heat and cold, etc. The two crocodiles below the throne denote the evil powers of Typhon under the subjection of the ibis.
Yeah, okay. So the Isiac Tablet of Cardinal Bembo is the name of the book that we're going to be, it's actually really short. I've included it in the chat box. You could go ahead and make that available, BL. And if you're really interested in and it's absolutely a fascinating study in the interpretation of these figures, you get the whole nine yards. So we'll be quoting from it extensively, but not in full. You know, that would take more time than we have. But yeah, you can just click on that link and it will appear in in your browser online, and you can read it from there or download it. Okay. Next, each pair of triads in conjunction with the center produces a septenary, and a septenary is contained in the center. Okay, there are two triads depicted on either side of the central figure. We've already talked about that, triad one, triad two, but they're of opposite character, which, you know, in terms of balance actually makes sense that you have a fiery and a watery on either side, you know, with the dominant fiery on the left. As you're looking at it, it would be on the right from the perspective of the figure in the center, and a lesser watery, and then just that reverse, a major watery and a minor fiery. So it's already, you know, there's a sense of design in the balance of these watery and fiery elements. And it is philosophically sound to see each double triad completed by the central figure, symbol of the universal being. The two sevens, you see, 6 plus 1 and 6 plus 1, equaling 14, which was particularly significant in the ancient Egyptian thought, considered, because they considered any unity to be made up of 14 parts. For example, the afterlife journey through the Egyptian Duat or underworld has 14 stages or gates that the talking about portals. Here's another example, you know, that the deceased must pass through to reach the afterlife, with each stage representing a different trial or challenge. That would be the outer version. The inner would be progressively more purified states of being that test the worthiness of the traveler. Egyptians were also keenly aware of the lunar cycle, having 14 days before, 14 days between the new and full moon, and again between the full moon and the new moon. And finally, the fact that Osiris, another symbol of unity, was cut into 14 pieces by Set, the personification of chaos. So this sum total, this 14 sum total, you could say, is represented by these four triads in that central panel. MPH tells us that the central figure is also septenary, as shown here. See the seven aspects there, or forms that make up this central reality. This would be much like the seven Prajapati that issue forth from that Hindu unity that would be Shivic in nature. Finally, the three septenaries furnish the absolute number of the three worlds, as well as the complete number of primitive letters to which a complementary sign is added, like 0 to the 9 numerals. So here are the three septenaries, the two triads on either side, with their seventh represented by the synthesizing central figure, and then that figure itself with its seven components. In ancient Egyptian thought, the cosmos was seen as consisting of three primary realms. First, the sky, or heaven, was ruled by the sky goddess, shown here, Nut, and was the domain of the sun god Ra, who traveled across the sky during the day and through the underworld at night. Second, the earth realm, personified by the god Geb, shown here holding up the sky. This realm encompassed the physical world, including all the natural elements, plants, animals, and geographical features. Geb represented the stage for human activities and interactions with the gods. And finally, the third realm was the Duat, or underworld, the realm of the dead and the afterlife, where the souls of the deceased journeyed after death, remember again, through 14 gates. The Duat was ruled by Osiris, the god of the afterlife, made up of 14 parts, and was filled with various challenges and trials that the deceased had to navigate to achieve eternal life. So these three realms were interconnected and played a crucial role in the ancient Egyptian understanding of the universe, of life itself, and of the afterlife. MPH here suggests that the 21 aspects of the middle tier represent these three worlds. The 21 also relates to the quote, complete number of primitive letters to which a complementary sign is added, like zero to the nine numerals, giving in total 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. Aleph, signifying the one and all, is zero, which is the Mensa, which in the Mensa Isiaca would be represented by the IYNX, the central figure, the one who manifests through the 21 and is the source of those 21 aspects. So we're starting to get a little sense of the internal logic of this Mensa Isiaca, even though it's, like I say, if you look for each one of these little aspects, you know, the headdresses, etc., you're not going to find parallels in the ancient Egyptian. It almost seems random, you know. They're all familiar looking, but when you actually look into the iconography, there's no parallels. But as I've said, it does have its own internal logic.
Francis?
Yeah.
Magda says the ibis, the phoenix, on Tot's head symbolizes conquering of the eye. As the crow talks of astral body sublimation, the swan for the etheric, and the peacock for the physical.
Okay. I'm not familiar with this iconography, but it's very interesting. The ibis, or phoenix, you're equating the ibis with the phoenix, which makes sense. Toth's head symbolizes the conquering of the eye, the lesser self, you know, which is what phoenix represents, the reborn in the flame of higher mind. And ibis, or Toth, was a third aspect god, you know, really a manifestation of the intelligence aspect, or active intelligence, creative intelligence, during the Egyptian era. And then you further say, and I'm not familiar with this, says the crow talks of astral body sublimation. In my own work with Native American studies, shamanism, this makes sense. And the swan for the etheric and peacock for the physical. Yeah, they make sense. I don't know these associations directly, but yeah, thank you for this. It's interesting. And Magda, go ahead.
Yes, these are birds, symbols of Rosicrucian traditions.
Okay.
And for instance, when they talk about dreams of some great mother, dreams of the swan, then you can tell son that she's birthing. I think this was, I don't remember which master, but anyway, she dreamt of a swan, and that means that the son received the etheric body, etheric sheet of a very high degree, meaning a very sublimized etheric sheet, etheric body.
That makes sense.
And so the other bird too. Yeah, it's Rosicrucian symbolism.
Okay, good to know. All right. Yeah, I'm glad for that insight into the ibis. That's quite interesting. It fits quite well. All right, let's see. Okay, so next up, can we get a reader, please?
Magda, can you read that for us, please?
Yes, let's hint. A Levi's hint may be construed to mean the 21 figures in the center section of the table represent the 21 major trumps of the tarot cards. If this be so, is not the zero card cause of so much controversy, the nameless crown of the supreme mind, the crown being symbolized by the hidden triad in the upper part of the throne in the center of the table? Might not the first emanation of this supreme mind be well symbolized by a juggler or a magician with the symbols of the four lower words spread out on a table before him? The rod, the sword, the cup, and the coin? Thus considered, the zero card belongs nowhere among the others, but is in fact the fourth dimension and point from which they all emanated, and consequently is broken up into the 21 cards, letters, which, when gathered together, produce the zero. The cipher appearing upon this card would substantiate this interpretation, for the cipher or circle is emblematic of the superior sphere from which issue the lower worlds, powers, and letters. Westcott carefully collected the all too meager theories advanced by various authorities, and in 1887 published this now extremely rare volume, which contains the only detailed description of the Isaiac table, published in English, since Humphrey's translated Montfaucon's worthless description in 1721. After explaining his reticence to reveal that which Levi evidently felt was better left concealed, Westcott sums up his interpretation of the table, of the tablet as follows.
Thank you. Thank you, Magda. Okay, a lot here. We'll take it bit by bit. First, Levi's hint may be construed to mean that the 21 figures in the center section of the table represent the 21 major trumps of the tarot cards, the hint being, talking about the zero and the 21 letters, which of course directly correspond to the numbering of the major arcanum. So Levi actually tells us in his History of Magic that the Book of Thoth was preserved in the form of the Tarot. Quote, "Now this alphabet is the famous Book of Thoth, and it was divined by Coeur de Gobelin in that it has been preserved to our own day in the form of Tarot cards." Next, if this be so, is not the zero card cause of so much controversy, the nameless crown of the supreme mind, the crown being symbolized by the hidden triad in the upper part of the throne in the center of the table? Okay, so here's Isis' throne, which at first glance has no apparent triangular qualities, but if we diagonally divide the inverted L of the upper part of the throne, a diagonal that is indicated by this point, the upper right corner of the small rectangle with the dog in it, we get a triangle, which might represent the hidden triad referenced by MPH. The idea then being that the lower quaternary is symbolized by the sublunary icons in the rectangle beneath the throne, which together with the rest of the central panel represent the 21 arcanum of the Tarot, all of which emanate from Isis as the central point, who, according to MPH, represents the zero arcanum. Thoughts, questions about this? Maybe. This construct is philosophically interesting, but we have to ask, was this really the idea that was embedded in the Mensa Isiaca? I mean, maybe. There's no empirical proof of this connection. You know, the Tarot didn't come into existence until 1400 years after the Mensa Isiaca was created. So, you know, it's all speculative, but it does have interesting philosophical and numerical correspondences. Next, might not the first emanation of this supreme mind be well symbolized by a juggler or magician with the symbol of the four lower worlds spread out on the table before him, the rod, the sword, the cup, and the coin? So the magician as the first emanation connecting the higher realms represented by the zero of the fool, and the lower quaternary represented by the four icons of the lower arcana, does seem to have a direct philosophical correspondence to the central figure of the Mensa Isiaca. In both, we have four icons in the lower square. See here, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And the diagonal dividing diagonal dividing the throne is coincidentally even at the same angle as the two arms of the magician. Now, I think this is pure coincidence, but it's a funny thing about coincidence. You know, they can both be calling on the same esoteric inner truth without being directly related in an outer way. So that's one possibility. Certainly an interesting detail. Next. So, you know, even though you're not going to hold on to, you know, the specific details of what, you know, each of these items means, you can, I hope, gain a sense of the philosophy being shown here, you know, of the higher triad and the lower quaternary. In both cases. Okay, next up, thus considered, the zero card belongs nowhere among the others, but is in fact the fourth dimensional point from which they all emanated and consequently is broken up into the 21 cards, letters, which when gathered together produce the zero. I would say the zero produces the 21. The gathering together of them would require a transcendence to get back to the zero. But anyway, the correspondence being that the 21 figures in the central panel of the Mensa Isiaca are likewise emanations from the one universal deity in the form of Isis, whose staff, to carry the analogy a bit further, is the axis, there it's here, that connects the superior, terrestrial, and subterranean realms, the three Egyptian realms. Okay, thoughts or questions? You want to get into the conversation? That'd be great. Next. The cipher appearing upon this card would substantiate this interpretation. For or the cipher or circle is emblematic of the superior sphere from which issue the lower worlds, powers, and letters. Okay, so the cipher appearing upon this card is the zero of the Fool Arcanum over here, which is represented by the Aleph in the Hebrew alphabet. From the Orphic egg of the Greeks to the golden Hiranyagarbha of the Hindus to the primordial egg of the Egyptians, ancient cultures around the globe, and I'm just also thinking that the Japanese have their mythography has also this original golden egg from which the three descended. We're going to learn that in the Secret Doctrine in a couple of weeks. Ancient cultures around the globe believed that some form of cosmic egg was the source of all manifestation. Next, Westcott carefully collected the all too meager theories advanced by various authorities, and in 1887 published his now extremely rare volume, which contains the only detailed description of the Isiac tablet published in English since Humphreys translated Montfaucon's worthless description in 1721. Well, don't hold back there. Okay, so W. Wynne Westcott's book, entitled The Isiac of Cardinal Bembo, has fascinating detailed passages on the Mensa Isiac. It's really reading these that convinced me, you know, left no doubt that though the figures in the table have only a cursory connection with the actual Egyptian gods, the figures within the table have a profound interconnectedness, which we discover in this detailed description of the central figure. So at this point, we'll actually dive into some more detail about these figures in the Mensa. Now that we have a kind of framework for this, I see it. Chad, is that anything? Okay,
yes.
Go ahead.
Ben says, there's the fool's dog from under the Isis throne, the dog star Sirius.
Two extra credit points for that. Yeah, I didn't put that together, Ben. That's great. Yeah, there it is, huh? How about that? You know, another coincidence, quote unquote, right? The dog, which, you know, probably represents the form aspect. Also, Isis and the dog star, you know. You have to look at that as well. And, you know, and for that reason, there's that same association with the, let's see how far I have to go back to get out. Yeah, if we go back to the, where am I at? 100. If we go back to the, wait a minute, it's not that far back. Oh, here it is. Yeah. If we go back to the fool, yeah, we see this purified physical plane aspect. You know, this is like, it seems etheric to me. Also notice how it mirrors the qualities, the gesture, you could say, of the fool, you know. So, yeah, so its association with Isis would definitely come through the dog star. Okay, all right. So can we get a reader for this, please?
Ben, can you read that for, please?
In the center is placed the most important design, consisting of the great gate of the gods, an architectural canopy over a throne on which is a seated figure. On the top of the canopy are shown diverging flames. Below is a globe double-winged, and then a second winged globe A third is also seen below the speed of the seat of the figure. Around the sides of the canopy are a series of squares in which are circles with eight divisions. A column marked with alternate black and white bands and surmounted by a head of Isis stands on each side of this canopy. Seated within is the figure of a female, dressed from waist downwards with feather markings, and having many closely placed breasts not shown in the drawing. On her head, a fillet and a Numidian bird, the turkey, surmounting this. On its back, a basket from which arise two persea leaves and two horns. These latter bound a disc on which is a scarabaeus. In her right hand is a lotus flowered scepter, and in her left hand is raised in attitude of command. Her seat is plain, but a sitting dog is engraved on it. Below her seat is another design, an abacus, within which lies a monster nefer, part lion, part hawk, a canopus between its forepaws. Behind it is seen a globe winged and combined with a serpent. Over its head is a crescent moon and the sun within it. On each side of the canopy are placed columns, and on each is a serpent, as if as a guard. The Isiac tablet of Cardinal Bembo. Cardinal Bembo.
Marianne has her hand up. Francis, did we lose you?
You got me back. Sorry about that.
Okay, Ariane has her hand up.
Go ahead, Ariane.
Yes, I'm so sorry I'm late and I'm trying to get acclimated here. So this is a drawing or a tablet from that you're linking with the tarot cards. This figure of Isis, she also looks like Horus to me. Her face is like, and she has the horns and the disc. Her face has that kind of, I don't know, owl hawkish look to it, not only the headdress. And then the staff is the lotus flower, I guess, of enlightenment, is like the rose that the fool is carrying. I'm just wondering, could you just say a bit about the tarot? I mean, I, as far as I know, and I've used it a little bit, it's a divination tool. Maybe they're beings that some, I read somewhere that they're actually beings assigned to help with the tarot and as a communication device with humans. I don't know if that's true, but I just, those two cards are, the fool and the magician are, you know, one of the others, my life symbol. I always thought it was the fool. Now, more recently, someone redid my name or whatever, and it's now, it seems to be the magician. But at any rate, I'm interested in knowing what this is all about. Like, why are you presenting this? And why is Manly Hall presenting this at this time? And what are the links? What is the role of the, what is the importance or function of the tarot ultimately? And where does this come from, this tablet? I'm sorry if you've answered all that. Maybe you could just make a summation to reset this class, reset the room.
Yeah, well, first of all, this chapter is about the Mensa Isiaca, which is here. Let me go out of this so you can see. I'll go back to the... see, where am I? 99. So let me go back to where it's shown in its whole. Okay, so here's what it looks like in total, right? This is called a metallurgical wonder made up of a number of different metals that was created according to modern metallurgical study in the first century AD. It's not Egyptian origin, but it has its own extraordinary inner logic. And what we're doing is exploring this. And it's one of its associations, and it's pure speculation, is that it relates the central panel, the 21 aspects of the central panel relate to the Tarot Arcanum, which are philosophically are emanations, and this is something that's philosophically held in Egyptian thought. Philosophically, in Egyptian thought was emanated from the central source, which was considered to be the like the central spiritual sun depicted on the head of Ra, right? That zero is the, or that sun-like shape is the zero of the Tarot Arcanum. So these arcana, these 21 stations, we're not getting into the divination. Any vehicle of truth will have a divinatory capacity, but it was not created for that process. I'm deeply interested in the Tarot, but not particularly in its divinatory process. I'm interested in the interrelations of the qualities of these archetypes that are described in these 22 Tarot Arcana, right? Which, according to MPH, are shown or indicated in these four triads of the central Mensa Issey Aka. So it is, as in terms of, you know, why MPH chose to develop this theme, who knows? You know, there's a rough progression between the chapters, and this he felt was important enough to include. I think he does a completely separate chapter on the Tarot itself, because it is a process by which it's a form, you could say, through which the ageless wisdom expresses itself. And that's what MPH has chosen to explore in this Secret Teachings of All Ages. Okay, now let me get back.
Ben says, the 21 cards gathered in a higher dimension, like the Yod containing all the letters in the alphabet, we saw Yod was Virgo Isis.
Yeah, the Yod, it's peculiar that it's the Yod that is chosen. I mean, from one point of view, it's peculiar in that it's one of the simple letters, the last, where is that letter, group of letters? Here, yeah. Okay, first of all, 99. Yeah, so it's down here. You know, you would think if it's the source letter, it would be Aleph, right? Which is the zero of the Tarot. And this is universally accepted. These associations between the Hebrew letters and the Tarot are developed, and I'll be talking about this a little bit, by a number of people who've written on the Tarot, like Paul Foster Case, who makes very convincing arguments about the associations. But look, Yod's way down here, you know, in the middle of the simple letters. So how is this the emanating source? But it's not held just by Tarot people. This is, you'll see this developed in my next episode of The Secret Doctrine, that it's also considered the source of the the Tetragrammaton, you know, that the Yod was is the highest of those four letters, Yod, He, Vav, He, right? So, yeah, I need to find out more about that, but so it is. Okay, so we're here and here. Does that catch us up on chats?
No, I'm typing one as I'm trying to talk to you. What I'm doing is adding the link to your series on sacred geometry that you did a couple of years ago, because you went considerably into the tarot there with the information that you presented on sacred geometry. So anyway, that's now in the chat.
Okay, good. That's those couple of years have now become five, Beale.
Has it been five? I thought it was more like 10, but.
Seems like 10 in some ways, in terms of the way things have unfolded. But it was the first series I did. Yeah, I recommend it if you want to have a deep study of each number, a 1 through 12. It's a good series for exploring that. Okay, so we read this. Okay, it is also by means of Westcott's book that explanations of the capital letters found throughout the tablet are explained. For example, there are three principal figures on each side of the goddess. Each triad, OQR, you can see that they're highlighted in red here, on the left, and XYZ on the right, consists of one seated figure and two standing ones. Note that the O and Z are clothed alike. Now, wait a minute, no. The O and Z, so the Alpha Omega of this central group, are clothed alike. R and X, R and X next to the canopy have similar pedestals. See here and here. Wands and headdress. Canopies, wands, and headdress. Yes, indeed. Q is ibis-headed, and Y is a seated female human figure. That's here. Okay, so he's just giving us physical characteristics here. Much more important than this description is the interpretation that immediately follows. As we read the following, keep in mind that the word M-E-N-S, mens, means mind or intelligence, because that word's used a lot. Could we get a reader, please?
Okay, hold on a minute. Magda says, this table is a numeric representation of 3, 7, the planets, and 12, the signs. 7 plus 7 is Isis. She is the seventh figure in the central strip, and she sits on 7 figures.
Yeah, nicely said. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, and as for a reader, Vivian.
I'm seeing a question from Nisa as well. What did the symbols in front of the outstretched hand? Oh, okay. That's what we just discussed. You got that now, Nisa? So if we go back one. Right. Oh, come on. Yeah. So we see here, she says, what do the, sorry. What do the symbols in front of the outstretched hands of O and Z mean? We're going to get into that. These would be magical talismans. Literally would be representations of a magical utterance, O and Z, yeah. I'm really glad you brought this out though, because there seem to be, as does this figure in the central one in front of her left hand, seem to be that which is being sent forth by the left hand represents the intention of the figure, and this represents the content of that intention. Good question, Nisa. Thank you. Okay, let's see, get back to where we were. Oh, got ahead of myself. Is this where we are? Wait a minute, I got lost. So, mens means intelligence. So, yeah, we are here.
Okay,
Yeah.
yeah.
Okay.
So, this central canopy represents the diffusion of the triform supreme mens in the universal ways of the three worlds, from which process of evolution the sensible world or universe emerges, called by Plutarch the Bourne of Horus, and by the Egyptians the Great Gate of the Gods. The diverging flames on the summit of the canopy mean the eternal and incorruptible supreme mens, full of fire, light, and life. The influence is communicated to the intellectual, sensible, and elementary worlds, as pictured by the three winged globes. The seated figure is the supreme mind, or Pantomorphos, Inx, Multiform, Sphinx, or Logos,
It's
Word,
actually, that's actually, I just, you just say the letters. It's like,
IYNX,
yeah.
the Pantomorphos IYNX, Multiform, Sphinx, or Logos, Word, or Soul of the World, and is placed here in the middle, as in the center of universal nature. The sitting posture denotes power and dominion. The dog is drawn on the seat because the Issaic lynx is associated with the dog star Sirius or Sirius.
IYNX. It's yeah.
Oh,
It's
yes.
always IYNX.
Sorry, I was thinking of the
It
animal, the
definitely looks like lynx, but yeah, go ahead.
I'll get there in the end. Also, this. The feather-winged clothing of the limbs denotes the sublime velocity of the higher powers. I've got something blanked out here. Higher powers. The abundance of breasts, is it, denotes the unlimited powers of creation and preservation. The necklets denote the celestial orbs in constant movement. The fillet on the head, or covering, denotes the hidden procedure of nature. And the turkey, the Numidian bird of Martial, of many colors and spots, denotes the variety of created things. The basket denotes abundance, and the persea denotes that wisdom which administers all events. The horns denote the moon, and the scarabaeus and disc, the sun. The scepter denotes that all things are modeled after the something of the paternal mens, and the lotus means the unwearied procession alike by night and day. The raised left hand denotes the ruling power whose every command is fulfilled. This mother of universal nature, the Egyptians called Isis. Of her, they indicated the inscription. I am Isis. I am all that is, that has been, and that will be, and no mortal has ever yet withdrawn my veil.
Yeah, so this is the soul of the world, and which is in keeping with the Egyptian philosophy about Isis, about that goddess in Egyptian theogony, right? And so we have this central figure is in keeping with the original Egyptian meaning in many ways, including the two horns, which you often see on Isis figure, on the figure of Isis. It relates her to the, she represents the third aspect of nature at its source. You know, she's the feminine counterpart of Thoth, the intelligence aspect in that way. And that nature aspect is represented by both sun and the moon. And the scarabus moves from one to the other. So it's all three aspects that, you know, that moving from one to the other is the central aspect. The sun would be the first aspect in this context, and the horns, the lunar or sublunar. So, you know, you could see we could spend the rest of the time just going back through this and talking further on it. But, you know, if you want to contemplate it, download the book and you can do a word search and find this section real easily. Okay. Any thoughts or questions?
Yeah, there was a follow-up from Nisa on her previous your description. She wants to know if those images were like projected energies.
I think so. Projected, that specific quality of magical energy, which has intention and form, right? Or archetypal form. So that's my take on it. You know, it's not just a diffuse energy field, but is a very specific command that would be represented by these group of hieroglyphs in each case. Yeah, here we have it here and then here. I think it's just down here because there was no room to put it right outside our hand. So, okay. All right. Finally, we have, after explaining his reticence to reveal that which Levi evidently felt was better left concealed, Westcott sums up his interpretation of the tablet as follows. So let's just go right into that. Can we get a reader, please?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and read it. The diagram of Levi, by which he explains the mystery of the tablet, shows the upper region divided into the four seasons of the year, each with three signs of the zodiac. And he has added the four-letter sacred name, the Tetragrammaton, assigning Jod to Aquarius, that is Canopus, He to Taurus, that is Athens, Vow to Leo, that is Mompta, and He final to Typhon, or is that He final to Typhon? Note the cherubic parallel, man, bull, lion, and eagle. The fourth form is found either as scorpion or the eagle, depending upon the occult good or evil intention. In the demotic zodiac, the snake replaces the scorpion. The lower region he ascribes to the 12 simple Hebrew letters, associating them with the four quarters of the horizon. Compare the Sefer Yetzirah, cap verses section 1. The central region he ascribes to the solar powers and planetary. In the middle, we see above the sun, Mark Fox, and below it, Solomon's seal, above a cross, a double triangle, hexapla, the one light and one dark triangle superimposed, the whole forming a sort of complex symbol of Venus. To the Ibimorphus, he gives the three dark planets, Venus, Mercury, and Mars, placed around a dark triangle erect, denoting fire. To the Nephathion triad, he gives three light planets, Saturn, Luna, and Jupiter, around a light inverted triangle, which denotes water. There is a necessary connection between water, female power, passive principle, Bina and Seraphotic mother, and bride. You want me to read the reference?
I apologize. If I was to do this again, I would include this. I would just put the text below this illustration because it doesn't mean a lot without the illustration, you know. So, but we'll pick it up now as we go back through it. So, the diagram of Levi. By which he explains the mystery of the tablet, shows the upper region divided into the four seasons of the year. I'm going to go ahead and switch over there. Okay, here's the diagram. I think it's more important that you see this than just following my words. So starting again, this is the diagram that appears, you see it at the central center of the page here, right? So, let me just talk about this a minute. The upper panel of the ECAC tablet is described by the 12 aspects, and the upper panel are described by these four geometrical figures, the lower 12 by these four geometrical figures, and the central panel, which we've been talking about, is shown here, and this is what he focuses in on in this description. So the diagram of Levi, by which he explains the mystery of the tablet, shows the upper region divided into the four seasons of the year, each with three signs of the zodiac. So the seasons were called Bindus, Amol, Mofta, and Omfta. And they represent three signs of the zodiac, which are indicated by their the symbol for those signs. And he has added the four-lettered sacred name, the Tetragrammaton, you know, the Yod, the He, the Vav, and the He. Assigning Yod to Aquarius. Here we have Yod to Aquarius. And it's the fixed signs are the top circle in all cases, which is also called Canopus. He to Taurus, that's here. Vav to Mofta. Vav to Leo, sorry, which is also called Mofta. And finally, He to Typhon. Which is also called Omphta. So here's the reference explanatory diagram that appears in Levi's History of Magic, which is reproduced in the center of this page of the Secret Teachings. Here is the top register of the Isiaka with Levi's explanatory diagram above. I've repositioned the triangles to appear more directly above the relevant triad of characters. So literally these circles represent the figures that occur below. Through Levi's illustration, we are given the identity of gods and goddesses in the upper register. So beginning with the winter solstice, to which Levi assigns the Yod, we have the triad of Capricorn, Aquarius, and Pisces. According to Kircher, Mendes was the ancient Egyptian name for winter. Levi's triangle represents the three aspects, Pater, which means paternal force or generative principle, mens or mind, which refers to the cosmic organizing intelligence that underpins the natural order, and potentia, or inherent potency, the dynamic creative force that brings ideas into reality. Potentia symbolizes the active and energetic aspect of the triad, representing the ability to manifest and actualize. These three aspects can be found personified in all four of these triads that are shown here. So here's Kircher's description of the winter triad. I was going to read this, but when Ben read it, I was able to follow along just fine with pointing out, which is my point here. So if we could get a reader and just read slow enough that I can point out the letters as we go along. Reader, please. Oh, we actually are out of time, but we'll read this one and then call it a day.
Ariane, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. In the first triad, S, the pater, V, the mens, or mother, and P, the potentia, from the triad of Mendes, the goat, which is seen on the altar M. This symbol refers to the fecundity of the earth, ready to nourish the germs of growth. It was customary to sacrifice goats at this season as an appeal for a favorable season. Capricornus, translated into the skies, according to the Greeks, refers to Mendes. P is male, and V a female. With tumid breast, each carries a crux ansata, token of the apotropaeum numen, or intercessory deity. These are symbolical of the active and passive powers of nature. Q and T are tablets acting as amulets.
Thank you, Ariane. Okay, any thoughts or questions about this? You can see that, even though, this headdress will not be found looking just like this on any Egyptian goddess. And nonetheless, this Mensa Isiaka has its own internal interconnected logic, right? And is really all-in-one, it's really almost like a miracle. There's nothing else like it. There's never been a metallurgical specimen found, anything like this, that is an instrument of the ageless wisdom, as I see it. So we'll stop there, pick up next time. Are the dates straightforward this month, Biel?
Not really. Ariane has her hand up.
Yeah, let's finish with Ariane and then go into the dates.
All right, just quickly. So the goat is also a symbol for Capricorn, the lower aspect at the base of the mountain. So it seems like it's also symbolic of overcoming one's lower aspects in some important way. And yep. the goat is looking directly at the figure, almost as if the figure sacrificing it has a relationship to it, while the figure is looking elsewhere. So it seems to be like in a hierarchical image about evolution, that one has to sacrifice the lower to the higher.
Yeah, I think that's a good analysis. You could say in a way they're the same, you know, that this is the form nature of this pater, this Capricornian archetype, right? That you see the Uraeus here indicating this, the higher knowledge. And that this inner being, you know, we think of it as the soul, it's ultimately the monad, and with that it must sacrifice its lower self, you know, as it reaches the mountaintop, you know, where the goat has been climbing. That's the animal that represents, you know, that transcends the sheep of the plains. It represents that which moves up the mountain only to become the unicorn on the mountaintop. And that's the transcendence. So yeah, that was a good analysis. Okay, dates.
All right, it's not straightforward. The next TCF, Treatise on Cosmic Fire, would normally be on the 11th of April, and it has been preempted because that will be the pre-full moon. Okay, so the next Treatise on Cosmic Fire is actually going to be on the 25th of April, and that will be at 7 p.m.
Okay.
The next Secret Doctrine will be as scheduled on the 20th of April, but it will not be at 7 p.m. GMT because there's some earlier Easter programs. So it will start at 8:30 GMT on the 20th of April. So we'll be an hour and a half later starting for the Secret Doctrine, just for that one day. And then the next Secret Teaching of All Ages is right on schedule for May at 7 p.m.
Really? I thought because of the conference that was getting preempted. But
Oh.
No, yeah, I don't think we're having it. I don't think we're having any May program.
You know, you may be right. I'm sorry. Let me verify that.
Yeah. I think by the time we get to May, all bets are off.
Yep, you're right. You're right. That one was postponed. I mean, it was canceled. So yeah. Sorry about that. The next problem. Secret Teaching of All Ages is going to be 1 June at 7 p.m. Yeah. So and we have that conference the right. Second and third week of May. So
I hope you all are there. Yeah, hope you all are signed up. I think it's going to be a goodie. I don't really know much about the main conference, but I know that both the rheology and the esoteric astrology pre-conference, that's just going to be really good material. So you'll want to sign up and check it out. It's, yeah. So my plug for the conference for sure. BL and I will both be presenting in the, actually in both of those pre-conferences. Okay, you all, thanks very much for attending. And so looks like our next connection will actually be the Secret Doctrine, since we're skipping the TCF webinar on the 11th. Am I right on that?
Well, that's true, but you're the one doing the free full moon on the 11th, right?
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah. I see that sort of as another thing, but yeah. So next thing is the pre full moon, and then this Secret Doctrine following that. So if you get confused, just check out the calendar. This would be a real good month to check out the calendar in on the Moray Federation website. Okay, much love to you all. Thanks for attending. I really like this material. I wish more people were aware of it because I think they would be interested, but there you have it. Okay, thanks, BL. We'll see you next time.
Bye, everybody.